stars, yellow stars, and green check marks. If an email needs a reply, it gets a yellow star. If it's time-sensitive, personal, or just more important, it gets a blue star. A blue-starred email takes priority above all yellow stars. And then, if it's something I want to keep handy because it contains useful information but doesn't need a response, it gets a green check. This process takes about 5 minutes. If it doesn't get a star, it isn't going to get answered. Then, assuming there is nothing urgent, which usually there isn't, I get on with the most important stuff. Go in for the kill. The writer Nicholas Chamfort once jokingly advised that if you swallow a live toad first thing in the morning, nothing else will seem too challenging for the rest of the day. I'm not sure that's true, but he's definitely right about one thing. If you start the day off with the hardest thing you need to accomplish, you are going to enjoy the whole day a hell of a lot more. How are you going to really relax when the thing that you are dreading the most is still to come? How often do you not get to it when you put it off until later? How well do you usually sleep that night? The answers to those questions are, in order, you're not, a lot, and like shit. Still, the human tendency is to put off the hardest thing to the last minute. Procrastination may create urgency, but at what cost? The stress of the large task will occupy valuable brain capacity as it builds momentum until finally you can't take it anymore. It will force you to overlook and ignore and lose on the little things that could have been small victories. It will turn your task from art to math as you count the minutes remaining and divide by the amount of work that you have left. So why do we always procrastinate then? We're missing the skill you learned in the shower, thanks to Bodie Miller. Mental override. The ability to make yourself do the thing you know you should, even when you don't want to. It is what Stephen Pressfield talks about when he says that he doesn't wait for the muse to show up. He sits his ass in the chair every morning at 9 a.m. and starts writing. So if the muse decides to come, she knows where to find him. In the words of General George Patton, accept the challenges so that you can feel the exhilaration of victory. Learn to say no. The sports psychologist Dr. Jonathan Fader, who advises the New York Mets along with many other high performers, is fond of sending out a framed picture of Dr. Oliver Sacks speaking on the phone. Behind Sacks, on a large piece of yellow paper, is the word no, written in block letters. Dr. Fader wants clients to hang this picture up in a prominent space near their computer to remind them they must say no a lot. I want you to do something similar in your own office. Put it up next to the piece of paper with your mission written on it, so in the morning and after lunch, when you are reviewing your emails, you feel empowered to ignore most of them, answer only those that are most important or urgent to you, and to respond with a more polite no to those making demands on your time and energy that do not service your mission. No, I'm not interested. No, I can't attend. No, I'm not available. No, I won't do that. The more you say no via email, the more effective you will be. I want you to have that sign so you're able to say no to other things too. No to self-doubt, no to fear, no to procrastination, but most of all, say no to distraction. Block out distractions. The key to blocking out distractions is, oh, hey girl, what's up? If you were a pro, you can't afford those kind of distractions. That's why when LeBron James or Kevin Durant gets off the team bus before a game, he has his headphones on and eyes fixed forward as he walks straight to the locker room. They do this not just because it's part of their daily routine, but also because they can't afford to get distracted by people they recognize, by fans wanting to take pictures. That stuff is for after the game. Now, they have work to do. By leaning on routine and blocking out all distractions, athletes like LeBron and KD are fighting off momentum killers so they can focus on the most important task at hand, getting to work and getting the job done. Being effective. So when it comes to productivity at work, first things first. Invest in an expensive pair of noise-canceling headphones or a white noise machine. You want to drown out what's going on out there so you can focus on what's going on in front of you. Second, turn off every kind of notification you can. Notifications are the sticker burr in the sock of effectiveness. They are the pebble in the shoe, except worse, because they come with interesting sounds and customizable buzzes and bouncing icons, all sorts of habituating dopamine triggers designed to grab your attention and keep it. But your attention is precious, because attention is time, and that is the only resource you cannot renew. So guard it well. There are a lot of fancy software apps that can block things from your computer, but I just go old school. I figure if I don't have the willpower to block out my own distractions, I won't have the willpower to write. Similarly, I want to train my will to be stronger than the opportunity. So I minimize all the tabs on my browser other than what I'm working on, and make sure that no notifications are going to pop up. For my phone, I turn on airplane mode, put on some trance-inducing tunes, and off we go to the happy, purposeful, productive land of effectiveness. Prescription. There are three things to focus on when it comes to owning your workday. 1. Know your mission. When I get into work, I know my mission because I have it on a journal I keep in my man purse with me at all times. We'll talk about journaling in Chapter 14. I used to call it a satchel, but one day a flight attendant called it a purse, and I realized that instead of defending my manliness and calling it a satchel, I would just go with purse. Man purse. Anyway, my mission and my objectives for the day are right there with me. Once you figure out your mission, write it down and put it somewhere you'll see it. 2. Own your space. The first thing I do is turn on my Zen fountain and my oil diffuser. I create a variety of different scents using 7 or 8 different essential oils. Sometimes I mix cedar oil with a drop of rose for that masculine vibe. Sometimes I mix peppermint and bergamot. I'm like a chef coming up with a daily special. Do the same for yourself, whether it's recreating a trigger scent you already have positive associations with, or experimenting with new scents that might become tomorrow's trigger scent for owning the day today. As the day goes along, I get up regularly to go for a walk or bounce on the rebounder. Make sure you practice good posture, get up from your desk on a regular basis, move around and support your teammates, whoever and whatever they may be. Don't let a question mark-shaped spine turn your productivity or your effectiveness or your professional integrity into a question mark as well. 3. Work effectively. When it is time to grind, I power through my morning email review, tell everyone I'm unavailable, turn off my cell phone, and go to my super secret bat phone, and I leave the office. I have too many people coming in and out and too many distractions to really be efficient on larger tasks while I'm there. I'll go to a coffee shop or cafe, or somewhere I can focus without distractions. Preferably someplace without highly attentive servers who feel like they aren't doing their job if they leave you alone too long. Once there, do whatever you have to do to minimize distractions and get down to whatever is the most important objective of the day. Now do it. You ever hear the cliche, if you do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life? It's bullshit. I love what I do, and I generally feel good after a full day of work. But it's fucking work. Sometimes it's brutal, it's demanding, it's exhausting. The pressure can seem insurmountable, and that's all to be expected. Anytime you are pushing the boundaries of what you are capable of, it will be work. Hard work. Because you are coming up against the internal points of resistance within your mind and your soul. If it wasn't work, it would be a problem, and I'd be worried. Daniel Cormier, a dominant light heavyweight UFC champion, has a saying, embrace the grind. Training for a UFC fight sucks. It sucks so much worse than your job. You have a whole group of people trying to kill you every day, trainers sucking the last bit of energy out of you, media up your ass, a lot of times you're away from your family, and the grand finale is a weight cut where you starve yourself of all food and water and then stand on a stage in your underwear in front of dozens of cameras and sometimes thousands of people like a show pony. Then, after all that, you may still get your ass kicked and spend the night in the hospital. If that is the life you chose for yourself, if that is part of your mission, you better embrace it. What you will find once you embrace the grind, whatever your grind may be, is that all of a sudden it isn't so bad. It is never pain that is the problem. It is the suffering caused by the resistance to that pain. Eckhart Tolle describes this in his world-shaking book, A New Earth, when he talks about the only three states of mind anyone should tolerate: acceptance, enjoyment, and enthusiasm. To accept is to embrace, to meet without resistance or judgment or preference. To enjoy is to move past acceptance and actually have fun while you are doing it. And enthusiasm sits beyond enjoyment, where you are bringing your intent and your passion into what you are doing. So when you approach the workday today, you can power through just like you always have, slouching through distractions, procrastination, and then ultimately panic. Or you can do it better. You have a choice. You have questions to ask yourself that only you can answer. Can you support your body while getting shit done? Can you optimize your workflow to accomplish even more? Can you embrace the grind? Can you make it better for your team? That is owning it. It's not how many hours you log or how many words you churn. The question is, can you do it well? If you follow the steps in this chapter, you can and you will. You're not at work to fuck around. You're at work to do work. Go, hero, go. Three pointers. More important than enjoying every minute of the work you do is knowing why you are doing it. This is your mission, and being certain of that mission will allow you to flourish even in challenging situations. To own your work, you have to own your space. This means cultivating optimal conditions for yourself within your environment by paying attention to your posture and movement, as well as the energetic and olfactory conditions of your workspace. Working effectively means accomplishing your best work with the minimum amount of resistance. To do this, you need to minimize distraction, learn to say no, and develop a process of prioritizing what you need to tackle first. Chapter 8. Eat a Weird Lunch. Tell me what you eat, and I will tell you what you are. G.K. Chesterton. It's called a lunch break, so let's break with the ordinary. It's become a cliche for important people to have the same lunch every day, a way to reduce their decision load. Ugh, boring. What kind of awesome day rings in the halfway point without the spice of variety? No more. Lunch is an opportunity to reframe and restart your day. It's not an obligation to cross off the list. It's also an opportunity to get your body the micronutrients it needs to keep you feeling great. The way to do that isn't with something ordered off a cart. It's by experimenting and exploring. It's by taking my hometown's motto to heart and keeping it weird. Getting owned. My favorite lunch as a young man was the Carl's Jr. Double Western Bacon Cheeseburger. I would order it 2, sometimes 3 times a week, and with that first hot, steaming bite, every time I'd think to myself, what is this creation of the fast food gods? This Zeus burger that has me slobbering like a pit bull in a butcher shop. Back then, I thought the sandwich was a savory flavor explosion designed by super geniuses, proof of man's inherent dominion over nature. I would gleefully crush it with reckless abandon, then bask in the post-coital euphoria of a multiple flavorgasm for all of about a minute and a half. Then I would literally feel sick to my stomach and drag ass the rest of the afternoon. Why? Well, let me tell you what that sandwich really was. It was meat and bacon that had been shot full of hormones and antibiotics and raised on Monsanto corn. It was yellow cheese that was somewhere in between milk and Nickelodeon GAC, engineered not for flavor but its ability to melt over the all-beef patty like a coat of high-gloss latex paint. It was sugary barbecue sauce for tang and breaded onion fried in canola oil for crunch, all of it sandwiched between 2 fluffy slices of refined blood sugar-spiking carbohydrates. How many of you fall prey to similar guilty lunch pleasures or worry that you have poor lunch habits? Not sure? Then answer me this. How many of the following things do you do or have you done on a regular basis at lunchtime? 1. Decided what to eat based on how many or few calories it has. 2. Bought a sandwich from Subway because it's fresh. 3. Eaten some form of fried starch like chips or fries as your side. 4. Eaten a meal whose only colors are different shades of white and brown. Yellow cheese doesn't count. If you were anything like I was, you've done all of those things, many times. You've found yourself owned by cravings and convenience, only to be left battling inflammation, brain fog, low energy, and mood dysregulation, all of which prevent you from crushing it during your afternoon work session. There are a number of reasons for this. With an estimated 75% of the world's food produced from only 12 plant and 5 animal species, the lack of biodiversity in our diet is failing to support our second brain. Additionally, our culture's maniacal focus on calories instead of nutrients has left our bodies unbalanced and undernourished. Last, and I think most important when it comes to the midday meal, the typical lunch is often packed with what I call anti-nutrients, and far too few of the essential micronutrients you get when you eat weird foods in all the colors of the rainbow from fertile, mineral-rich soil. Eventually, I got to a point where I was sick and tired, literally and figuratively, of only being productive for the first half of my day and missing the giant opportunities I had to fulfill my mission and achieve the things I dreamed about when I closed my eyes at night. So I changed my lunch. And that's what you're going to do too, because that $5 footlong you've been eating every day is a $5 fuck-up. In this chapter, we're going to walk you through the right kind of lunch. You're going to spice it up. You're going to make it interesting, exciting, even weird. It's not going to be the same every damn time. It's going to take a little effort to prepare before you dive right in and devour it, but it's going to be worth it. And you're going to be doing your body a solid. As Orson Welles once said, ask not what you can do for your country, ask what's for lunch. Owning it. Take a deep breath. Lunch is about to get weird. But before we have some fun with it, we have to get fundamental. We have to address the nutrient profile of your overall diet and how that connects to your lunch. We need a solid foundation of macronutrients that provide the fuel for your body and the building blocks for your growth. All those proteins, fats, fiber, and carbohydrates that come from air, land, and sea. Once we have a handle on those, then we can dive into the weird foods that provide the key micronutrients that take you from functional to optimal. And finally, we can go to war against the anti-nutrients that are regularly undercutting the benefits of both your macro and micronutrient consumption. Universal Nutrition Principle Number 4. Calories are bullshit. Macronutrients matter. Nutrition coach Mike Dolce has captained thousands of dramatic weight loss and body transformations in his career, helping people from all across the spectrum, tall, short, white, black, male, female, Team Edward, Team Jacob. If there is one message that Mike has preached most consistently over all those years, it's that if you are counting calories, you are setting yourself up for failure, because calories aren't real and humans don't actually burn them. The calorie, as a unit of measurement, is based on the amount of heat produced when food is burned in a metal oven called a calorimeter. Last time I checked, our bodies are not metal ovens. They can become Dutch ovens with the appropriate amount of chipotle and chill, but even then we need a fully made bed to get there. What the body actually does is break down food in complex metabolic pathways, utilizing amino acids for muscles, shuttling nutrients into cells, and storing energy. When we work out, we don't burn the calories from the last meal we ate like a coal-powered engine. Energy in the body comes from a chemical called adenosine triphosphate, ATP, that the body generates from a variety of sources, including glycogen, ketones, protein, and fat that our body had previously stored. That's a very sciencey way of saying that calories are bullshit. Still, this is how most people think about calories. Food has them. If you eat more than you burn when you work out, you get fat. Full stop. If it were only that simple. Does that mean you can eat any amount of food you want? Of course not. But it probably does mean that you can and should eat more of the right macronutrients than you currently consume. The biggest surprise to many of Mike Dolce's clients, in fact, is just how much food he tells them to eat. Convinced by years of diet fad brainwashing of the calorie in, calorie out hypothesis, his overweight clients are shocked that when they eat more food than they ever have, they start losing weight. These anecdotes are plausible because when it comes to food and owning your health, it ain't about the calories, it's about the nutrients. The body needs good macronutrients to trigger the hormonal signals that help you start losing weight. 100-calorie pack of crackers is not going to be as good as a small handful of almonds or a couple pieces of grass-fed jerky or any of the weird foods we're about to talk about in this chapter. That is a nutritional truism that holds for more than just weight loss as well. Solid macronutrient intake is essential for optimal organ function, musculoskeletal function, and general bodily effectiveness. Protein. Build your house. Protein is a key building block within our bodies. Technically, proteins are chains of different amino acids that break down and rebuild to help us form our muscles, skin, joints, even our eyeballs. If the body were a house, it would be in a constant state of renovation, and protein would be the building materials. When the body starts to run out of those materials, it starts to age and degrade until it breaks down rather than building up. Eating enough protein, especially complete amino acid protein, as a regular part of your diet ensures that you supply your body with the building materials it needs to keep those internal load-bearing walls strong and, thanks to its role in promoting stable blood sugar levels, keep those lights on and burning brightly. That said, the big question with protein as a macronutrient isn't whether it's important, it's what constitutes enough and whether there is such a thing as too much. In a study including both young and elderly subjects, a meal consisting of beef that yielded 30 grams of protein elicited significant increases in muscle protein synthesis after an overnight fasting period. Interestingly, a meal yielding 90 grams of protein did not elicit any greater responses in muscle protein synthesis. What makes those numbers so significant is when you put them in the context of a Western diet and standard American portions. 30 grams of protein is only 4 to 5 ounces of beef, or about the size of the palm of your hand. An 8-ounce steak is 50 grams of protein by itself, and that's usually the smallest option on most restaurant menus. So, if you are totally looking for gains, bro, try hitting that 30-gram mark, because more is likely just going to be unnecessary extra work for your organs and your wallet. Ideal sources. Grass-fed beef, wild-caught salmon, pasture-raised eggs, sprouted pumpkin seeds, hemp seeds. Fiber. Slow and steady. If I were dietary fat, I would fire my PR agent and hire the one they have working for my friend Dietary Fiber. While fiber is technically a carbohydrate, everyone and their mother, especially their mother, has heard of the importance of fiber. But not many people know exactly why. To understand fiber, you have to understand the different types and how each can be beneficial to your body. We are going to focus on three main types: soluble, insoluble, and fermentable prebiotic fiber. Soluble fibers mix with water and form a gel-like substance. If you've ever had chia seed pudding or a chia slurry, you have a good sense of what this looks like. It almost has the consistency of jello. Soluble fiber, like its unjustly maligned friend, dietary fat, offers a variety of metabolic benefits when this process happens in the body, including slowing down the uptake of nutrients just long enough to help level out blood sugar spikes. You'll learn more about how to use soluble fiber to hack your cheat meal in Chapter 12. Ideal sources: chia, flax, asparagus, guar gum. Insoluble fiber plays an important role in making sure your digestive tract has enough substance to push through the system efficiently and completely. Some of the most common sources of insoluble fiber are plants without much nutrient density, but whose cell walls are made of cellulose. Like our friend psyllium, they act as a bulking agent, which helps speed the complete passage of food and waste through your gut. Basically, they become the plunger at the bottom of the push pop that makes it easy to shove all the shit out. All right, who's hungry? Ideal sources: avocado, sprouted barley, mixed greens, popcorn, psyllium. Fermentable fiber, or resistant starch, is often called a prebiotic because your friendly neighborhood gut bacteria are able to digest, ferment, it to use as food. Whereas probiotics actually contain more friendly bacteria to help populate your gut colony, prebiotics provide the food they need to thrive. The most common fermentable fibers include beans, the magical fruit, and as with all forms of fermentation, produce everyone's favorite bodily byproduct, gas. Not all fermentable fibers are created equal, of course. Some will be more efficient and tolerable for your body than others, and you'll just have to experiment to find out. Though I suspect you, or whoever you might share a bed with, already know. Personally, my favorite prebiotic fermentable fiber is dandelion greens. My body tolerates them very well. My least favorite are Brussels sprouts, which turn my digestive tract into a fart factory. Ideal sources: garbanzo beans, hummus, dandelion greens, chicory root, onions. A lunch with these fibers well represented will promote gut health and aid digestion. A healthy, well-firing digestive tract is key to preventing the kind of heavy bloat and discomfort that can derail what would otherwise have been a smooth, productive afternoon. Carbohydrate. Speed kills. With the exception of fiber, carbohydrates are basically sugar. But it is not their sugary nature that makes them dangerous. It is the speed at which they are delivered into your system. We talked about this in Chapter 3, so I won't belabor it. Just remember that your goal when it comes to carb consumption is to slow them down as much as possible. The speed at which you digest caffeine depends on what else you've consumed with it. Chewed up food, or chyme, will digest at the rate of the slowest absorbing nutrients within it. Fat and fiber take longer for the body to process than sugar or starch, and are therefore two of the best nutrients for slowing down digestion. The best way to eat carbs, then, is to eat things that already have the fiber in them. Things like yams, sweet potatoes, quinoa, sprouted or fermented grains, and some fruits. A lot of people who are sensitive to their carb intake look at the composition of fruit, being largely sugar, and they come to the conclusion that fruit is bad. What they fail to realize, though, is that fruit is full of fiber. The fiber is a big part of what gives fruit its solid-state structure. Without it, most fruits would just be juice balloons ready to spill out all over the place. That relationship between the fiber and the sugar in fruit plays out in the body as well. Fruits don't just flood your bloodstream with sugar. The fiber in them slows down the absorption of the sugar in the gut, which basically spreads out the glycogen battery charge over a longer period, giving you longer to burn down your battery power. Remember, anything over 100% of your glycogen stores converts to fat. So if you can charge your body at a pace similar to the one you drain it at, you'll be fine on the fruit front. So if fiber and fat slow down the absorption of sugar, what do you suppose produces the fastest absorption? Well, something that has neither fiber nor fat. The liquid, greased lightning of sugar. Soda. If you do just one thing for your nutrition, for your workday, and for your world, stop drinking conventional soda and stop giving soda to your kids. Sugar-sweetened beverages contributed to a staggering 60% increase in childhood obesity. Sugar-sweetened beverages that use fructose, like fruit juice concentrates and high fructose corn syrup, are the worst of the worst. Fructose cannot be used in any other immediate functions of the body, so it immediately converts to glycogen or fat. When it comes to sugar, and especially fructose, you need to get them out of your diet so you can get their effects out of your day. Ideal sources: yams, sweet potatoes, sprouted or fermented grains, certain fruits. fat, fuel the burn. We've briefly discussed how high-fat diets like the ketogenic diet can help you lose weight. One way they do this is by curbing hunger through increasing the signal for satiety, the feeling of being full. This diminishes the desire to overeat, sometimes starting as early as the first bite of hunger-satiating fat. Your liver can convert saturated fat in your diet to cholesterol, but contrary to what you might have been told, cholesterol is not going to kill you. There are studies showing that even in the elderly, high cholesterol can be protective. In these older populations, the higher the cholesterol, the lower your risk of heart disease. Not to mention that cholesterol levels that are too low are actually associated with increased risk of death from other causes, like cancer and suicide. This likely has to do with the fact that saturated fat and cholesterol are the starting point for the production of many important hormones, including testosterone and estrogen. Whether you're male or female, having robust hormone levels has been linked to most aspects of healthy living, mood, body composition, libido, and energy level. Without good fat in your diet, without enough cholesterol, you will be setting yourself up for some serious problems. Ideal sources: coconut oil, animal fats, avocado, grass-fed butter, egg yolk, olive oil, MCT oil, cacao butter. You are what you eat. As critically important as macronutrients are to your overall health, it's equally important that they come from as many high-quality sources as possible. We've all heard the expression, you are what you eat. Well, that's literally true. You didn't grow from magic or because that's just what babies do. You grew because you ate stuff. But that's only half the story, because the stuff you ate grew because it ate and metabolized stuff too. You aren't just what you eat, you're also what you eat ate. Double Western bacon cheeseburgers, technically speaking, have a macronutrient profile you could get away with, especially if you throw one bun off and make it a convertible. But if that is all you ever ate, like I wanted to do when I was young, you would literally be made up of reconstituted and metabolized double Western bacon cheeseburgers. You would be a cheeseburger human, Carl's Jr. Jr., which might be all right depending on what you eat ate. Did the cow who so kindly donated the patty and the cheese eat grass and weeds full of nutrients and conjugated linoleic acid, CLA? Or did it eat genetically modified corn, packed with fructose? Did the onion come from nutrient-rich soil, or was it commercially farmed on refertilized ground that was regularly doused in Roundup? Was the bread refined wheat, basically cotton candy in the shape of a bun, or was it a sprouted grain, watered from mineral-rich springs or rainwater? Multinational food manufacturers have tried to convince us that stuff like this doesn't matter that much. But a cursory glance at the difference between natural foods and those that have endured even a modest amount of processing is all you need to know that this matters a lot if you want to own your day and own your life. Look at the higher concentrations of healthy fats like CLA in grass-fed beef versus conventional beef. Or just look at the food, period. Often you can actually see the difference in nutritional quality. Wild-caught salmon, with higher natural levels of the colorful antioxidant astaxanthin, have a much deeper pink flesh compared to farm-raised salmon, which would be unrecognizable without the red dye added for coloring. Pasture-raised chickens produce eggs with rich orange yolks, whereas factory-farmed chickens lay eggs with almost sickly yellow yolks. Even corn and berries, when grown organically, can have up to 50% more antioxidants. And veggies, well, they are only as good as the soil and water that made them grow. Anyone who has sampled the merchandise at a good farmer's market can tell you that it's not tomato versus tomato, it's tomato versus what the hell is that? All of which is to say, whether it's macro or micronutrients you're after, going conventional with your food isn't going to get you very far. You've got to get weird. Universal Nutrition Principle Number 5, Eat Weird Foods. Jonathan Swift said, "He was a bold man that first ate an oyster." Damn right. I wonder if old curious Jorge was actually hungry or just feeling destructive when he came across his first oyster. I can imagine him finding this sea rock that seemed to have something alive inside it, smashing it open and giving a good sniff. It smelled like the ocean, so he poked it with his tongue. It was slimy, yet familiar. Then fuck it. He eventually slurped the whole thing down for desperately needed sustenance. What is certain is that he had no idea how just a few oysters could supply 1,000% of his daily vitamin B12 needs, along with hefty supplies of vitamin A and E, copper, selenium, zinc, and essential fatty acids. Add in a bottle of Sauve Blanc, and he would have also had the world's first patio brunch, but that's a whole different discussion. This is the essence of weird foods. And the more diverse they are, the more diverse the micronutrients you consume, the closer you'll be to optimizing performance, and the farther away you'll be from the deleterious internal conditions that always seem to throw the brakes on the rest of our day. Microbiome-assisted foods. Besides taking a supplement to fix our screwed-up guts, the next best thing we can do is dramatically increase the type and variety of foods we eat. Because with that diversity comes a more robust and more diverse group of microbiota. The more diverse and plentiful your microbiota, the more potential health benefits they can contribute to the body. To get there, you need to hunt down prebiotic foods that feed the good bacteria that already exist, encouraging them to flourish, and probiotic foods that increase the ranks of those friendly bacteria. Prebiotic foods are those that feed the bacteria already present in the gut. Fueling those little dudes, which outnumber the rest of the body's cells 10-1, is pretty important, and why foods rich in fermentable fiber and resistant starch are also key. They survive the digestive enzymes in the stomach and small intestine and deliver their payload, principally inulin, among others, to the large intestine, where they can feed critical strains of probiotic bacteria, like bifidobacteria, which keep things efficient in the bowel system by helping reduce constipation and boosting the immune system. While lunch is not usually the time for a bunch of starchy carbohydrates like French fries, surprisingly, there may be a way to keep potatoes on the lunch menu in a useful prebiotic fashion. Potato salad. When you heat and cool potatoes or rice, you turn some of the digestible starches into resistant starch via a process called retrogradation. In addition to feeding your friendlies, the retrograded starch will have a diminished effect on elevating blood sugar levels, which will help you ward off the afternoon drowsies. The key with any prebiotic food is to start small and build up. If you eat too much right off the bat, you are going to have serious gas. Ideal sources: Jerusalem artichokes, blueberries, almonds and pistachios, and especially high quantities in chicory root, dandelion greens, and onions. Probiotic foods add more friendly bacteria into your system, the ones that not only break down food in the stomach, but also start breaking down food outside the stomach as well. Their helpful bacteria and yeasts feed on the sugars and resistant starches in the food, converting some of the sugar to organic acids and making the food easier to digest. Eating a probiotic food is kind of like hiring new intestinal factory workers who start working before they even reach the factory floor. They work a lifetime, multiply, have children during the fermentation process, and then when you finally consume the food, you add some of their numbers to your own intestinal factory. It's a win-win. The best place to find these probiotics is in cultured or fermented foods. Fermentation not only introduces a bunch of healthy probiotics, it also increases nutrient bioavailability and digestibility, making tolerable many foods like dairy, soy, or plants like cabbage that would normally be irritating to the digestive tract. Fermentation is a traditional practice around the world and commonplace in many of the world's blue zones. If you haven't heard that term, blue zones are areas of the globe whose populations enjoy the highest levels of health, and studying those populations can give great insight into some best practices we can all apply. Ideal sources: miso, kimchi, sauerkraut, kefir, kombucha, dark chocolate, Greek yogurt. Protective foods. There are a lot of different protective foods, to the extent that any nutrient-dense food you eat is probably doing something to benefit or bolster one of the systems in your body. But two classes of foods stand above the others for their essential protective nature, omega-3 fatty acids and antioxidants. Omega-3 fatty acids are called essential fatty acids because the body can't produce them and needs to source them from food. As we learned in Chapter 4, these aren't normal fats. These compounds play key roles in regulating inflammation and other processes like blood clotting. While both omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids are important, the problem develops when the ratio gets out of line. Research by Dr. Stefan Guionet suggests that the ratio in healthy non-industrial populations is somewhere from 1 to 1 to 1 to 4 omega-3 to omega-6, respectively. Unfortunately, in our typical diet, the ratio is more like 1 to 16, and we need to correct that, not just with supplements, but with diet. Ideal sources: chia, flax, and Sacha Inchi seeds, wild-caught fish like sockeye salmon, sardines, mackerel, grass-fed beef, as long as it isn't grain-finished. Antioxidants have been touted at one time or another as a cure for everything from cancer to the common cold. While the hype for antioxidants as a panacea was definitely overblown, what is absolutely true is that they reduce oxidative stress in the body by eliminating free radicals, hungry molecules on the hunt for electrons to quench their unending molecular thirst. When free radicals pull electrons from normal cells, those cells die as part of the inflammation process. Cell death is a healthy function that keeps deranged and damaged cells from wandering around aimlessly. But when there is too much oxidative stress, and there are too many free radicals roaming around like Pac-Man ghosts, you start to get more inflammation than you need or want. That is when it is time to reach for the antioxidants. With electrons to spare, there are several powerful classes of antioxidants that can blast thirsty radicals like a fire hose at a skinhead rally. Polyphenols help produce something called C-reactive protein, which is a marker of inflammation. The best sources for polyphenols are chocolate, red wine, and green tea. Anthocyanins are immune boosters present in dark fruits like blackberries, blueberries, acai, black currant, and cherries, as well as black rice and eggplant. Like Tupac and Kendrick always say, the blacker the berry, the stronger the anthocyanins. Curcuminoids have earned a lot of buzz for their ability to reduce inflammation. Found primarily in turmeric, whose yellow root gives curry powder its color, not only do they reduce oxidative stress, they are specifically valuable for the brain and may help reduce the burden of age-related brain conditions. Unfortunately, on their own, curcuminoids are hard for the body to absorb. But when you combine the turmeric with black pepper or the extract bioperine, the absorption can skyrocket up to 2,000%. Garlic is one of these mysterious foods that has been used therapeutically for millennia. It contains multiple antioxidant compounds that, among other things, subdue the common cold like a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt. A large 12-week study found that garlic supplementation reduced the number of colds by 63% versus placebo. That is awesome by itself, but even better when you consider the average length of cold symptoms for those who were sick was also reduced from 5 days to just 1.5 days in the group taking garlic. Another study backed up those results and found that a high dose of garlic extract can reduce the number of days someone feels sick with cold or flu by 61%. To get the maximum benefit, load up on garlic in the winter or if anyone in your house is getting the sniffles. Sulforaphane is an antioxidant compound produced when raw cruciferous vegetables like broccoli, Brussels sprouts, and cabbage are chopped or chewed. Evidence suggests that sulforaphane may help inactivate and eliminate carcinogens, as well as help decrease DNA damage by reducing inflammation, the underlying cause of many diseases. The highest concentration of sulforaphane is actually in broccoli sprouts rather than broccoli itself. As it turns out, it's not uncommon for sprouts to be more nutritious than their mature form. Ideal sources: dark chocolate, red wine, green tea, berries, black rice, turmeric and black pepper, garlic, broccoli sprouts. Vitamin and mineral, micronutrient-rich foods. Here's the deal. Pretty much every vegetable or well-sourced protein contains good vitamins and minerals. But if you're going to get all the trace micronutrients you need to really get your body and your brain humming on a regular basis, you need to vary your dietary intake and pull from the "what the fuck is that" part of the salad bar. Here are a couple winners. Cauliflower is so hot right now. Go to any modern food joint and you'll likely see some kind of unique preparation. Cauliflower rice, cauliflower flan, cauliflower pizza crust, General Tso's cauliflower. It's become the grain of vegetables with the added benefit of 900% fewer carbs than rice and contains all the usual vitamin and mineral suspects along with brain-healthy nutrients like choline. Seaweed or sea veggies contain high levels of ocean minerals, including iodine, magnesium, manganese, iron, and other trace minerals. One great way to add in seaweed besides eating sushi or miso soup at your favorite Japanese restaurant is to purchase kelp or dulse flakes. I have a great seasoning that includes sesame seeds and seaweed flakes that I sprinkle on all my stir-fry meals and even put in my bone broth. The seaweed snack game has really found its groove with sea crackers and dried nori as well. Organ meat, liver, heart, kidneys, sourced from pasture-raised animals, is one of the world's most nutrient-dense superfoods. While the taste and texture can be a challenge to overcome, the benefits make it worthwhile. It's packed with the most bioavailable forms of both vitamins and minerals. Don't be shy about doing your best Hannibal impression and eating some liver with fava beans and a nice Chianti. Universal nutrition principle number 6. Go to war with anti-nutrients. You know that old saying, 2 steps forward, 1 step back? When it comes to diet and health, anti-nutrients are the 1 step back, and they are just as important to avoid as the 2 steps forward we need to make with macro and micronutrients. These toxic compounds generally lead to oxidative stress and inflammation, which, as we've discussed at length already, is one of the most harmful conditions our bodies deal with on the regular. And since most of us are too chronically stressed out to be able to count on simply shutting off inflammation, limiting the inputs that trigger inflammation is the next best thing. Sugar, of course, is the biggest anti-nutrient of them all. If you'd like to revisit how excessive sugar horse fucks your health, head back to Chapter 3. But here we are going to cover the other dietary supervillains so that you might avoid limiting or reversing your progress. Trans fats and vegetable oils. Artificial trans fats, vegetable oils bonded with hydrogen, were created by food manufacturers to extend the shelf life of packaged and processed foods so they could sell more food more cheaply and farther away. The strategy worked, ballooning their bottom lines. Unfortunately, it also started killing us in the process, causing massive systemic inflammation that was the precursor to all sorts of chronic health conditions. In 2015, in recognition of this fact, the FDA took the remarkable step of removing trans fats from GRAS status, generally regarded as safe, despite the explicit trans fat labeling requirements already in place. The biggest problem with most vegetable oils like canola and safflower is that they are so high in omega-6 fatty acids, skewing the omega-6 to omega-3 ratio so disproportionately, that the only way your body doesn't slip into a pro-inflammatory state when you consume them regularly is if you start every morning with a salmon-sized suppository full of fish oil. These oils are in all kinds of foods, including baked goods, fried goods, spreads, and sauces. The most offensive, though, are the fake butters and margarines. These are so packed with pro-inflammatory, cardiovascular disease-inducing vegetable oils that people who replace their butter with margarine are more likely to die from heart disease, according to the Framingham Heart Study we first discussed over breakfast in Chapter 3. So here's the move. Anytime you can't believe it's not butter, or you see something with trans fats, throw that shit in the trash. Even if it says 0 gram trans fats on the packaging, double check that the ingredients don't include anything listed as partially hydrogenated blank oil, because that shit is trans fat. Companies get to claim zero because the FDA allows them to round down for anything that contains less than 0.5 grams per serving. Spare yourself the fraction math and just throw it all out. Simple. Done. No further discussion necessary. And as for canola and safflower oil, just do your best to limit your intake and vote with your dollars for products that don't contain them. Fried or burned foods. When you're cooking for your health, even if you're indulging in some delicious pan-fried foods, you want to make sure you don't heat your fats, olive oil, butter, coconut oil, to what is called their smoke point. This is where healthy fats start to turn unhealthy, because once they burn, they start to produce toxic compounds called aldehydes, which, interestingly, are also in the class of compounds that accumulate when we drink too much alcohol, making us feel hungover. This chemical conversion process is why I told you to keep your bacon bendy. When you burn it or fry it on high heat, the sodium nitrite that naturally occurs in bacon, as well as the nitrates that are often added for preservation, can turn into a nasty carcinogen called nitrosamines. Not only is this bad for your system, but it also ruins one of nature's tastiest, porkiest gifts. To this point, asking you to hold off on your coffee until after breakfast has probably been the biggest bummer for most people, but I suspect asking many of you to eliminate the crisp bacon isn't much better. Well, guess what? It's about to get worse, because part and parcel with not burning your bacon is not charring your meats. I know that dark crust on burned ends and bone-in ribeye steaks is mouth-watering good, but for the sake of optimizing your lunch and reducing the carcinogenic effects on your body over the long term, let's go ahead and dial all that back for a little while. Pro tip: fry with avocado oil. Avocado oil has the highest smoke point of all cooking oils. With a nice, mild flavor, it's great for any kind of sauté or stir-fry. And with a smoke point upward of 500 degrees Fahrenheit, you'd be hard-pressed to scorch it unless you crank the burner to 11 and then forget about it. Pesticides. While major players in the agricultural industrial complex like Monsanto will defend their use of pesticides on crops by telling you that it's fine to spray Roundup in your face on a hot day to cool off, you would do well to proceed with caution when you consider that numerous studies over the years have demonstrated disturbing links between pesticides and a host of gnarly shit. One study found pesticide residues were 4 times more likely on non-organic crops, while organic produce saw a 48% lower presence of cadmium, a toxic metal, than their non-organic counterparts. In a study of 1,139 children, researchers found a 50 to 90% increased risk of ADHD in children with the highest levels of pesticides in their urine, compared to those with the lowest levels. Another study noted a correlation between those gardening with the pesticide rotenone and the development of Parkinson's later in life. Does all this mean you need to go run screaming from the conventional produce section at your local supermarket? No. Just understand that pesticides are not good for you, and that eating organic as much as possible will be the surest way to avoid the anti-nutrients conventional produce contains. Chemicals. There are all kinds of chemicals found in food, but perhaps the most ubiquitous are the food dyes. An analysis of over 15 clinical trials, compiled well over a decade ago, showed that artificial food dyes increased hyperactivity in children, and yet they still remain in food. Tartrazine, also known as FDNC yellow number 5, found in many of those tasty mac and cheese boxes and Kraft singles marketed to kids, is particularly ugly, having been correlated with behavioral changes including irritability, restlessness, depression, and difficulty sleeping. So Velveeta doesn't make it better after all. It's not just food dyes, though. A huge study looking at 1,873 children showed that food dye in conjunction with sodium benzoate, a common preservative, also increased hyperactivity. Is it any wonder that we're handing out ADD medication to our kids like candy? Blame it on culture all you want, but it might just be what's in your pantry that's the problem. Reversal. Eat real food. If anyone is trying to trick you into eating something by making it a different color, you probably don't need to eat it. Real food is delicious. Any of your favorite processed foods could be replaced with a healthier, real version for just a little bit of time. Heavy metals. We're not talking about Metallica. We're talking about death metal, namely, your own death from metal. Remember our indefatigable old friend Tony Robbins from Chapter 2? Well, his favorite thing to eat was tuna and swordfish steaks, and it almost killed him. The reason? Mercury poisoning. Like most larger and longer-living predatory fish, tuna and swordfish are extremely high in mercury, and over time those metals can build up in the tissue and wreak havoc. In a study of 129 Brazilians, for example, higher levels of mercury were associated with a decrease in fine motor skills, dexterity, memory, and attention. Further evidence suggests that low levels of mercury toxicity are linked to diseases like depression, anxiety, and even Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Interestingly, canned tuna has a much more reasonable level of mercury than a big-eye tuna steak. So if the preservatives and additives are not off the charts, and you need your chicken of the sea, snagging some cans off the grocery store shelf may be your best option. If you are concerned about heavy metals, whether because you live in a polluted environment, you had a bunch of dental work 30 years ago, or you are a sushi addict who is 25% spicy tuna roll by weight, definitely get your blood levels tested. In addition, consider adding a daily dose, about a quarter cup of cilantro, to your diet. Packed with vitamins and minerals, cilantro, or coriander leaves if you're not from North America, in moderation has been shown in several studies to have the unique ability to help the body chelate, a fancy word for eliminate heavy metal accumulation. In the animal model, it has even been shown to prevent the accumulation of metals. Either way, it is important not to overdo it with cilantro chelation because the metals can become mobilized during the elimination process and enter even more sensitive tissues. To prevent that from happening, you want to open up all the channels of detoxification. In other words, make sure you are drinking plenty of water to flush urine, having regular bowel movements, and sweating to release the toxins. Sauna and hot yoga are great ways to ensure you are moving enough sweat. Phytic acid and oxalate. Phytic acid and oxalate, or oxalic acid, are natural chemicals found exclusively in plant species that protect and assist the plants in which they're found, but inhibit mineral absorption when consumed by humans. Phytic acid, found in all edible seeds, grains, and legumes, helps protect the seed and stores phosphorus that young plants use to grow. When ingested by a human, it prevents full absorption of key minerals like iron, zinc, and calcium. Oxalate is found in particularly high concentration in leafy greens like kale. It is part of the plant's natural anti-pest defense mechanisms, but binds with minerals, particularly calcium, when consumed, and makes them less available for use in key cellular processes. Fortunately, there are strategies for mitigating the anti-nutrient properties of both of these sneaky little devils. Sprouting or fermentation disable and degrade phytic acid in plant seeds so that the grain can burst through, increasing vitamins like folate, vitamin C, and vitamin E, and nutrients like lysine, a crucial amino acid for immune health, in the process. The tastiest version of this process is probably sourdough bread. The fermentation of the dough promotes phytate breakdown to a much greater degree than typical yeast fermentation in normal bread, resulting in a delicious delivery mechanism for a slab of real butter and mineral-rich sea salt. The best way to handle the oxalate in your leafy greens is simply to boil or cook them, which significantly reduces the amount of oxalate, in some cases by up to 90%. Adding calcium to your dietary regimen can compensate for the calcium lost to the oxalates as well. Caveat: fuck your gluten sensitivity. If there is one thing I have learned in my personal and professional journey, it's that the mind is a powerful thing. Nowhere on the